Chapter 9.
You could not say with perfect accuracy that you woke up. Having achieved a grotesque molliance and dripped and resolved into a bad-smelling puddle of yourself, you did piece yourself back together again. Your eyes opened. You were lying flat on your back, and slowly, carefully, with great effort of soul, you congealed. A weird hard wad was present in your lungs, pairing each breath with a hideous trachea whistle. Otherwise you were fine, though dishevelled. Your robes were askew. Your chest was heavy, but not with water, with the shadow of a memory, or the last remembrance of a dream. For a moment you shivered all over. After your lungs, your eyes were the second thing to connect, and they perceived a room both big and dark, with spatters of quiet yellow light. This light resolved the shadowed angles of a high and vaulted ceiling. You recalled the wetness. You recalled the corpses. But then that recollection slithered away. The only thing you could hold on to was where you had been sat. You would know if all your sensation was removed. You would know if your brain had burnt away. You were the Reverend Daughter, and you had been placed in a pew. A heavy weight pressed on your hips and legs. You strained to see, chin tucked hard against the top of your chest, and beheld with relief your double-handed sword. Your relationship with it was becoming increasingly complex. You hated its presence, but the world without it would be unimaginable. You smelled blood. You smelled something else more distantly. Above the blood hung the crisp, fecal sweetness of a rose. You struggled to sit up. The breath seized in your lungs, and you worried yourself out of a thrusting cough just as a hand touched your shoulder, lightly, in warning. You nearly flinched off your seat. "Quiet," said Ianthe, beneath her breath. She was sitting next to you, an incandescent pillar of white staring straight ahead. The look on her face was typical of her, a recollection, an icy, exhausted tedium with top notes of intrigued disgust. You were dazed. You hated her to touch you. You glued the sword to the back of the pew with a push, the bone lifting it and muffling the noise, sticking in hot gobs to the genuine wood as you swung your legs over to press your toes to the floor. And you saw where you were, and you were immediately stricken with horror. You had been laid in a pew, halfway down a small, exquisite chapel. Now that you could look, you recognised the tender and yellow light as that which came from hundreds of candles. They lit an interior of shining charcoal-coloured stone, layered with walls of bone. Bone everywhere. Bone enough for 100 ninth house tomb chapels. The chancel formed of long-carved runnels of bone, fretworked into human lace. The black check tiles polished granite beneath your feet, their white counterparts soft, worn squares of femur, orange in that lenient candlelight. And the seats of wood. Wood like you'd first seen in Canaan House. Real, brown, glimmering wood, polished to the particular sheen that neither stone nor bone could take. You stared up at a plex cruciform window. Cold stars outside, gleaming with a weird and unearthly light. You stared up at skulls. An ossuary of skulls. A multitude of skulls, set into the wall, overlapping in empty-eyed rows, set cheek by jowl to await infinity. Thin sheets of metal had been worked over this lovely mass of faceless dead in shadowed tints. Deep red crimsons, smoky amethysts, lightless navy. House colours. House heroes brought here to rest. Slender columns of white tapers bathed those bones in forgiving lights that made them beautiful in the way only bones could be for you. The candles were wrapped in different colours, which made them look like the dressed-up throats of flowers. or rings on long, slender fingers, and great clusters of these candles shone down on a central altar, and on the central altar was a body. You were at a funeral. You knew its bride. You'd killed her. You sat in a pew in the chapel, where had been laid the time-apprehended body of Kithareya the First. In order to survive the ghostery of your presence, you sent your brain voyaging elsewhere. You tucked your hands deep inside the veil of your nacreous sleeves and slumped so that the snowy rainbow gauze hid your face. Even the vague pressure of the blade at your back caused the gorge to rise up in your chest and your heart to hammer wildly, as though trying to construct a barricade. But at least the threat of coyly spewing kept you present and sane. You weren't that far gone. It was only the fourth funeral you had ever been to where you had been responsible for the corpse. The corpse on the altar was covered in little blush rosebuds scattered thickly over her, a roseate white like seconds-old bone. They lay in sheaves in her arms. They were tucked in her pallid brown curls and pressed to her feet. On her sweet, dead mouth, there hovered a rueful frown. Once upon a time, you might have fallen to position on the kneeler, soft and supple human leather, buttery, lovely, and thanked the tomb that you had lived to see the death of a lictor, enshrined so in such a place. You would have pressed your prayer beads to your mouth with one knuckle caught between your lips, the knuckle of your great-grandmother that represented the rock and the universe and God. Now you considered whether or not you could pass out again. Before the altar knelt Mercy Morn. Her shimmering white robe had fallen down her shoulders, and she was weeping. The sound was not articulated aloud, but her shoulders rocked as though her sobs were an explosion. She ground her molars audibly, so much so that they sounded like walnuts going through a rock polisher. You could not imagine the Saint of Joy weeping with anything other than fury or disappointment. Next to Mercy knelt God. Next to God knelt somebody new. You could only see the back of the head, and you surmised they were fair-haired. That was all. The stranger was tall, kneeling, taller than the Emperor and taller than Mercy. They wore the iridescent robe of the First House, and you could not sense them. Another black hole in a triplet of black holes, scooping out the space in front of you. After a moment, the new figure said in a light, masculine tenor, "I will have a full psychological meltdown if you don't stop that ghastly noise, Mercy." The Saint of Joy gritted out, "I will kill you if you talk to me right now, you mean-souled little man." The God of the Nine Houses said, "Stop it," and they were silent. The molar clunching subsided gradually. You wove your fingers together in your deep pearly sleeves and bent your thumbs backward, nearly to the point of dislocation. Ianthe looked at you, and when you looked at her in the candlelight, her eyes not betraying her, right now they might have been blue, you were struck by her exhaustion. She had been dimmed somehow. Something had been taken from her since you watched her scream on the floor of the shuttle. Her line of sight flicked to the gap at the front of your robe. You shouldered forward to close it, and she quirked her eyebrows in brief, enervated amusement. You mouthed, "Where are we?" But she did not answer. After a moment, the Emperor spoke at the corpse in the smiling cadence of a man giving a talk at a dinner party. "When they first brought her to Canaan House, I thought there'd been some mistake. You know that I'd been to Rhodes to see the miracle, but I asked not to see the woman, just so I could be a disinterested party. And of course, once I saw that she was necromantic, I said yes. She should come to me to be a disciple. She was just shy of 30 then, I recall,
and I knew she was sick, but I had no idea how bad it was until Loveday brought her in, looking as though she wanted every one of us beaten to death, and she could hardly walk. I went to kiss her hello, and she said, "Lord, I can't kiss you back. My lipstick's perfect, and I refuse to smear it."
The strange lictor barked out a hollow laugh.
He
inclined his head, and you saw him in part profile for the first time. He was very fair, but in a greyish, damp, slicked back way that showed off the promontories of his skull. Fine, impatient lines were set around his drooping eyes and quite deeply carved into his mouth. He looked older than your father had looked when he died. These haughty features were set in a tall, aristocratic face with an arched and supercilious nose, which nose he was currently staring down at the Emperor with an expression of supreme suffering.
"It wasn't, though. She had it on her teeth."
Mercy Morn muttered, but not so quietly that it wasn't audible.
"Of course you'd notice that, Augustine."
But Augustine was adding, in a light, cultivated voice,
"I remember now. Lord, the time flies. That was a damnable business. They sent her to us barely alive, and back then none of us could do anything for her excepting you. Was she the first gen or second?"
"Second," said God. "Early second. We were still experimenting with getting the sixth installation up and running. Some of the houses were empty."
Mercy Morn spoke up. "No, we had it running by then, because Valency was with us, and Anastasia."
The Emperor clicked his fingers as though she had triggered some neuron flash.
"Yes, you're right. We were all there to meet her. All 16 of us, and she acted as though she were at a wedding and was doing a receiving line of tedious cousins. I could hardly keep a straight face. When was the last time you saw her?"
This last question was asked a little abruptly. Both lictors fell silent for a moment, and then the one they called Augustine said,
"Recently, 10 years ago, I told her she was getting to be a bit of a hermit, and she acted as though I was rather stupid, but she seemed in good spirits."
Mercy Morn said,
"Kithareia was good at seeming,"
to which Augustine just said a little distantly,
"You'd know, I'm sure."
Before this could decompose further, the Emperor pressed,
"And you, Mercy?"
You heard the molar grinding again.
Then the Saint of Joy said, colourlessly, "Nearly 20 years ago,"
and,
"She laughed too much."
All three of them fell silent at the altar. The wasted body in front of them would no longer laugh too much in any case. Augustine said,
"Does anyone remember her name? Her actual house name? Didn't she have one?"
The Emperor suggested,
"Heptane."
But Augustine said,
"No, you're thinking of Loveday. We've forgotten it. That's unnatural. Who would have ever thought we could forget a thing like that?"
Mercy Morn stood. She tucked her hair behind her ears and away from her deceptively serene oval face, and she crossed primly to the back of the altar. She put her hands behind her back, as though afraid to touch anything with them. She looked at Kithareia's dead face with an intensity that was, in its own way, worse than tenderness. It was as though she were willing something from the corpse, like she could conjure something through sheer force of wanting.
"Call her Kithareia Loveday," she said. "That's what she wanted to be called, and I found it unbearable and glutinous then, and I find it unbearable and glutinous now. But that is what she said. I never saw her cry except once," she added in a pointless rush. "The day after, when we put together the research, when she became a lictor, I said, there was no alternative. She said..."
At this point, she broke off. Thankfully, she did not glance in your direction. Augustine was staring at the floor, hands crossed demurely in a posture of awkward respect, and the Emperor was looking up at Mercy, but all you could see was the back of his head, where mother-of-pearl leaves and baby finger-bones adorned his hair. The candlelight flickered heartlessly over you all. He asked,
"What did she say?"
The other lictor said nothing for a moment. She cleared her throat.
"She said, we had the choice to stop."
After a second, the Prince Undying sank his head into his hands. A stylus fell out of his pocket and rolled across the sleek black and bone tiles. It was the first time that he had seemed at all mortal. Humanity touched him briefly, like a passing shadow. Then Augustine said, quite irrelevantly,
"I wouldn't have called it glutinous. She was just lucky that Kitherea Loveday trips off the tongue. Now, mine would alliterate in a way I couldn't have abided."
"Abode?"
"I will say this," said Mercy presently,
acting as though Augustine had never said a word.
"I never mourned for Loveday, Heptane. She did one good thing with her life, and she knew it."
"Eulogize her," said the Emperor through his hands. "For God's sake, eulogize her anyway. Eulogize them both."
Augustine reached over and squeezed the shoulder of the man who became God and the God who became man, and yet still invoked himself, apparently. The lictor got up with a grunt as though it hurt him and went to stand at the foot of the altar. You saw now that he was tall, and not particularly imposing, but there was something removed from real life in the lineaments of his face, as though he had once looked at something terrible, and it had lodged in his cheeks and forehead. He twitched open his first house cloak and stuck his thumbs in the belt loops of his elegant trousers. His white robe floated around his shoulders like an overjacket, filmy and beautiful, and he cleared his throat.
"Kitherea was gorgeous," he said simply. 10,000 years, and I never heard her say an unkind word, except when it was very funny. She loved us unguardedly, all of us, which showed both her patience and her enormous capacity. She was a worthy lictor and a beloved hand, and Loveday gave her to us. So I suppose, God bless Loveday."
Mercy Morn pressed her hand down close to the small, fat blush roses. She had to draw herself together quite tightly. Her voice was light and a trifle strange when she said,
"She could be a dreadful little fool, but she was generally an endearing dreadful little fool, and her death was beneath her."
She slowly turned those dreamy hurricane eyes on the pews, which meant she turned them on you and Ianthe, and she started. She said,
"The infants are awake."
The kindly prince craned his head over his shoulder and saw that you, the infants, were awake. He stood and, horror upon horrors, came down the aisle to you. He looked you both over as though he were glad to see you, as though he were glad to see Ianthe, some nameless softening in his face and in those white-ringed primordial eyes. He reached out for your hands. You could not refuse him, and in any case had no choice of doing so. Your body reacted long before your mind did, and the meat of your meat and the flesh of your flesh belonged to God. And so, with your hand in his left and Ianthe's in his right, Ianthe had arranged herself so that she had given him her left hand rather than her less favoured right, he said,
"Welcome home. Come closer. We're just saying goodbye. We're used to saying goodbye."
Both you and Ianthe were led like sacrifices to the bier, to kneel where the other lictors had on the black and cream tiles. Mercy Morn did not deign to look at you, but the strange lictor they had both called Augustine did. He looked down his long nose at you both, and he remarked,
"Well, which one of the kiddies did her in?"
The Emperor said sharply,
"That doesn't matter."
"It's not like I hold it against them. I couldn't. Believe me,
If she went, she chose to go. Well, I'd hate to guess. Two of them. What a funny old world, he added bracingly.
The lictor came away from Kithareya's bud-covered feet and dropped to crouch in the transept before Rianthe. He said,
My name is Augustine the First,
the Saint of Patience, lictor of the Great Resurrection, first finger on the hand that serves the king undying, and your eldest brother for my sins.
Who are you, my doves?
Ianthe said lifelessly, I am Ianthe Tridentarius, Princess of Ida. And you said in the same automatic way,
I am Harrowhark Nona Jesmus, the Reverend Daughter.
Augustine laughed in a glassy and elegant way that had no relationship with mirth. He reached over and shook both your hands.
You were befuddled.
You had always considered a handshake the action of a misfit, and he said,
Not any more, your obedient servant, Ianthe the First.
You're the one who ascended first, didn't you? So you're counted as the eighth saint. Your obedient servant, Harrowhark the First. Ninth saint, then. Looking at you, I can tell that's appropriate. Your allegiance is to one house now, and one house only. Behind you is your eldest sister.
We've met, said Mercy impatiently. Can we not do this right at this moment?
I imagine she didn't have the grace to introduce herself, so I must. Mercy Morn the First, the Saint of Joy, would you believe? She is a lictor of the Great Resurrection, the second finger on those two hands so outspread that pray to the kindly prince, and she is all your sisters now. The one in front of you being, alas, completely dead. And I am the last of your brothers. Excepting. He trailed off, as though expecting God to fill in, which God did not. He finished with,
Teacher, do you think he knows about the missile strikes?
He's never been particularly interested in the day-to-day, said the Emperor.
But he is interested in you-know-what. And I'm just thinking, if he's heard, and maybe put two and two together.
God said, He had a mission. The Saint of Duty reflects his name.
Right, said Augustine. Unlike joy and patience. Quite right. Just coming back here and not seeing him, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, to be perfectly honest with you. I can't quite shake the feeling that something's wrong.
Can we get back to this blasted funeral? Said Mercy. Sitting through six of these is worse than dying myself. I will let you know now that the plan for my funeral is in my top drawer, and I've got it down to a minute-by-minute framework, and it's only 24 minutes, and it's just lovely.
I can only imagine, said her brother Lictor fervently.
This excruciation was cut short when the doors at the back of the chapel banged open. Everyone alive swung around in a hurry, and in walked the next terrible part of your life. It was a man, the missing lictor, as empty to you as all assembled, more still even than the frozen corpse of Kithareya the First. Unlike the other lictors, all of whom skewed hungry, soft men and women of the necromancer build. His frame carried nothing but muscle. He was sinew over bone. He was a walking tendon. He had a raw, stretched look to him like an idiot's construct, bones that had been slippered in meaty fibrils to keep them moving, a metabolized, contracted striation without fat, the only curve a hollow tautness from rib to stomach. The Emperor's face cleared.
Well timed, he said with naked relief.
The stranger wore the lictoral robe of office slung over his shoulders rather than enveloping him, and it was a shabby thing with a ragged hem that did not look very well cared for. He strode down the centre aisle too swiftly for you to see his eyes. In that brief glimpse you beheld a blunt brown face, skin too close to the skull,
all shabby, defeated features with its lineaments more temporalis muscle than anything else. His skull was a bumpy, knobbled, close-capped thing, hair shaven nearly to the bone. This hair gleamed a dull and unappealing russet, like a vague and bloody shadow on his head. The Emperor had risen to stand with his arms open in offered embrace. The muscle man walked into it briefly, enough to let God press one hand familiarly to his back, enough for him to clasp God round the shoulders, then pulled roughly away and directed his gaze to the figure lying bookended by Mercy and Augustine.
"She's dead," said the stranger.
When the Emperor nodded, he closed his eyes very briefly. Then he opened them and said bluntly,
"So are we. Number 7's at the rim."
At this statement, Augustine suddenly leant heavily against the altar. He looked as though he might fall over like a drunk. Mercy's lips turned to snow. They became an exaggerated painting of tragedy, a lithograph of the moment before shirts were rent and hair was torn and blood rain pattered over the scene. The Emperor had turned his terrible eyes on the stranger, and they looked like dead planets in the pitch of space, and the white ring was like dying. He was no longer human. He was immortal again.
"It can't move that fast," he said. "It never has. You must have seen a herald or a pseudo-beast. Look, don't scare the children. Come into my quarters and let's talk this out, all three of you."
The new arrival was immovable.
"It's number 7, said the stranger. "Run or fight."
Mercy said, "But we reckoned it at 5 years just a year ago."
"It caught up with us," said the stranger. "The brain is already in the river. If we drop through the waters, we'll run into it no matter what direction we go. The corpus will be here in just under 10 months, and it will be full of heralds. Run or fight."
"We need to think about—"
"No thinking," said the stranger,
cutting Augustine off without hesitation.
"Run.
Two of us take the Emperor and hike to the nearest stele. The one left stays as a distraction, then leads it away.
Or fight. We all make a stand.
John, I am your servant. Tell me to stay and die, and I'll stay."
You recalled that name from the shuttle, but had ignored it at the time. There was a ghastly moment now when you realized that he had looked at the resurrecting prince when he said John, that God had responded to so banal and cursory a word as John, and that he was looking at the rope-made man with something closer to despair than you had ever seen in him.
"We'll fight," he said.
"We made the choice years ago to increase our numbers and fight these things. 5 years, 10 months. In the end, perhaps it is the same."
"Stay," said the stranger.
"Yes," said God.
"Stay, I do think."
And lowly,
"Thank you for making it home, Ortus the First."
Something pulled inside your ears, culminating in a hot and intense dripping down your earlobes. You touched it, and your fingers came away wet. It was blood. Ianthe was staring at you through a fine curtain of achromatic hair, the whitened curve of her lips a tight and careful line. You silently crumpled up in the transept and hit your head quite hard on the tiles before you were rendered senseless. Under the circumstances, it took people quite a long time to notice.